Thank you very much for the kind invitation to present some of my work, which is very much work in progress. So I've come here to ask for help, please, in how I might develop this further. What would it mean to understand nationalism as an atmosphere? That's the question I'm trying to ask in this paper and the question that I'm posing for this presentation today. So in relation to the intellectual rationale for this seminar, I want to ask how we might study the role of ambiance and atmosphere in the construction of national and urban life. And how might the work of translating questions about feelings, emotions, affects and atmospheres put conventional approaches to nations and nationalism in crisis? So where I'm coming from here is I'm trying to move beyond social constructivist approaches to the politics of nationalism, which mainly focus around questions of memory, tradition, language, myths and symbols and so on, to try and get at some other sort of entry point to this topic. Now, the Olympic Games that were held in London in 2012 proved overwhelmingly popular in the UK, even with those people who had previously been very critical of them. So according to a report in The Guardian, the Olympic Games reminded those suspicious of raucous patriotism how great the Union flag suddenly looked when it was ripped out of the hands of the extreme right. This wasn't simply a temporary response. At the end of 2012, a Guardian ICM opinion poll reported that 78% of people in the UK were overwhelmingly happy with a £9 billion price tag, and that the Olympics did a valuable job of cheering up the country in hard times. Now, critical readings and responses to the Olympics that have sought to reveal the vast cost of the Games, or that have sought to show that the Games were primarily a corporate event, or indeed have tried to show that it was mainly a large-scale security site, have all failed to convince people that they should feel unhappy about the Games. Everybody knew that the Olympics were obscenely expensive, and yet the Games proved surprisingly popular. And the fact that there were more British soldiers on the streets of London than in Afghanistan for this period, and that surface-to-air missiles were placed on the top of apartment blocks in East London, didn't in the end seem to make much difference to how friendly people perceived the Games to be. So this implies to me that a critical approach can't rely on trying to expose the Games for what they really were, because all these facts and figures were mostly present and available. So this leaves me with a question of how we might go about trying to develop critique of these Games, and why should that task seem to be so difficult? This question has prompted one prominent psychogeographer called Ian Sinclair to express his resistance to the game by undertaking an epic journey down the River Thames on the back of a giant fiberglass swan. This was the only way in which he felt he could express some resistance to the Games and the whole claim that these represented a happy event. So the modern Olympics have a long-established, albeit varied, relationship with nationalism. So, for example, the turn-of-the-century Olympics were often housed within world exhibitions, such as in Paris in 1900 and London 1908. They served as key sites for displaying the cultural advancement of the nation and also to exhibit the superiority of a particular nation, people, by comparing height, weight, head shape, size, and so on, to establish comparison between different human types. What was interesting about the London Olympics of 2012 in relation to this seminar was that it was repeatedly said that there was something special and moving about the atmosphere of these Games. This claim was made again and again. This was symbolised by the helpful and smiling Olympic volunteers that came to be known as the Games Makers. And indeed, such was the buzz about the Games that empty plastic water bottles claiming to contain 100% Olympic bottled atmosphere started selling on eBay for a buy-it-now price of £50. So this happy atmosphere must, I think, be understood against the backdrop of the new austerity politics in Europe. But it must also be situated as following upon other recent mass spectacles of national identity in the UK context, such as the royal wedding and jubilee celebrations. So drawing on some of the work of the political theorist Wendy Brown, I'm trying to unpack here how the Olympics offered an aura of sovereignty, the idea that sovereignty is organised into distinct territorial cultural units, against the backdrop of a waning sovereignty that we're experiencing in the context of the economic crisis in Europe. Now, Wendy Brown draws very much on the work of Walter Benjamin, and thank you to Jean-Paul for pointing out to me earlier that aura might be one of the ways in which we could translate atmospheres in German. So I wonder if an atmosphere of sovereignty is something that could apply in this context as well. Wendy Brown didn't say this about the Olympics, incidentally, but she said it about the building of walls between the US and Mexico border and in Israel on the West Bank. So how these walls form an aura of sovereignty. And if we want to understand such walls in these terms, then that kind of poses a challenge to the idea that an atmosphere is something different to talking about territoriality, because this is talking about atmosphere and a territorial scription together. No, that's just an aside that I've been thinking as the seminar goes along. Now, while questions about joy and anger, passion and rage tend to form a recurring undercurrent in studies of nations and nationalism, questions about emotions tend to take second place to the task of explaining the history of the nation, for example. Also, questions about emotions tend to get treated as substances that derive from being part of a group or a community that is already assumed to exist. And I think a similar argument can be made about some of the literatures around urban sociology and urban geography, where there's still this assumption of a group-based identity. And the work, this term affective atmospheres that many people in this room, including in this room, have talked about, offers me a way of getting away from this assumption of a group-based form of thinking. So the literatures on affect and emotion can address the reciprocal relationship between how we are moved by different feelings and how we come to understand being in common. So, for example, from Melissa Gregg and Gregory Seagworth, who described the study of affect as a matter of paying attention to the ebbs and swells of intensities that pass between bodies, enabling bindings and unbindings, jarring disorientations and rhythmic attunements. So this kind of stuff is useful for me in trying to think about not how the Olympics express an already assumed national identity, but how feelings of being in common as a nation are formed through mass spectacles and perhaps individual events or gatherings in the context of the Olympics. So some of the work of Sarah Ahmed is very useful for me here too, as well as the work of Nigel Thrift. I'm aware that these are very much, you know, figures in the Anglo-American tradition of critical theory. So perhaps the first point to make in the context of thinking about the atmospheres of the Olympics was that these were not spontaneous. Indeed, a lot of work went into securing particular moods, feelings, emotions and atmospheres. So for example, we can see here on the bottom right-hand side something called the Mood-O-Meter, which was developed between McDonald's and the Sunday Times to record the mood of the nation during the course of the Games. And this project was echoed by something called Emoto, which was an art installation project that sort of tracked Twitter feeds talking about people's feelings of the games, and then turned those Twitter feeds into an art installation in order to represent the happiness of the nation. Also, sound was an important atmospheric, and the BBC made regular references to the decibel count in the stadium, for example, as a way of symbolising or capturing the atmosphere. So one of the methodological questions I'm grappling with in this paper, and I'm looking for help with, is how do I go about studying an atmosphere? I don't want to just conclude by saying, well, it was manufactured, and it was manufactured in these ways. So I think this was one of the first questions in for the seminar today. You know, how can I ground the study of sensory feelings and so on? And how in particular does one go about studying atmospheres that have already passed? So I can't be at the stadium again. So how do you try and access those feelings and affective atmospheres? And I think there are three approaches into the study of nationality that this concept of atmospheres is offering me. So first of all, to get away from the interest in territoriality in the study of nation states, so to try and ask about other sites and scales, if that's the right term, where sovereignty may be performed and produced. So this is drawing on some of the work of Luce Irigaray, the feminist theorist, and also the work of Peter Sloterdijk. Secondly, it allows me to ask questions about affects and the circulation of emotions. So in comparable studies about the atmospheres of suspicion that followed the events of 9/11 and accompanied the war on terror, the feminist and cultural theorists such as Jasbir Puar and Inderpal Gruel have tried to get away from social constructivist approaches to race and racism, for example, by asking questions about the circulation of feelings and how images of danger and risk and suspicion seem to stick to some bodies more than others. So these kind of approaches are useful for me. So also is the work of Pete Addy here and Ben Anderson, who argue that security apparatuses don't only work through fear, suspicion and rage, but also through fun and laughter and fatigue and other kind of emotional ranges. And thirdly, this concept of atmospheres allows me to return to an interest I've written about previously in the temporalities of nationality. And this is a theme that's come up in several of the papers today already. So it's well established, for example, in the study of nations and nationalism, that the nation is produced through a linear, homogeneous, progressive understanding of time. Thank you. But I want to develop the point that the nation is also imagined through a splintered and fragmented experience of time. And this is an experience that we can trace back through urban writers of the experience of urban modernity, such as Georg Simmel and Walter Benjamin, so that these twofold temporalities are crucial to the performance of national life. Now, the homogeneous, empty temporalities of nationalism were articulated at the opening ceremony of the Games, which was directed by filmmaker Danny Boyle. This opening ceremony narrated a story about Britain from the Industrial Revolution to the digital age. And this linear, homogeneous time frame was echoed also in the torch relay, which formed a sort of countdown towards the Games, and which toured all parts of the UK from Derry to Aberystwyth to the Shetland Islands in order to make people from all different corners of the UK all feel part of the Games. Now, it's no secret that the inaugural and modern version of the torch relay was first held at the Berlin Nazi Olympics in 1936. Again, it was surprising that this didn't seem to make any difference to how popular the torch relay was in the UK in summer of 2012. So, although the torch relay was presented as a way of taking the Games from London out to the country and to the people, it also worked to confirm the centrality of London as capital of the nation. I think that's why Hitler was precisely interested in the idea of a torch relay. Yet London, in the course of the Games, was also presented as a city that could bring the world together, an idea that, of course, carries distinct imperial and colonial histories. And indeed, these global flows that traverse through London could be read in the bodies of the injured soldiers back from Iraq or Afghanistan that were selected to carry the torch. And this is not a new narrative, of course. A similar idea of London as world city travelled with nationalist declarations of unity in the aftermath of the London bombings. And as geographers Felix Driver and David Gilbert remind us, we could also be traced right back to the turn of the century London Underground poster campaign that invited people to visit the Empire by taking a journey on the Tube, where you could reach Australia by simply going to Temple or the Strand, or India via Aldwych and so on. Stories about national and international progress, of course, often play out by way of narratives about women, as the second presentation today reminded us. And in the case of the opening ceremony, the story of the nation's progress dutifully included a section about the achievements of the British suffragettes. Just as viewers at home were told that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were entering women athletes to the Games for the very first time. So the capacity to compete as an elite athlete was presented as evidence of women's progress towards modernity and civilization here. To return to the torch relay, it was Samsung, Coca-Cola and Lloyd's TSB that sponsored this event and played a role in actively working to exude a sense of national belonging by asking people to tag their locations and their pictures of themselves with the torch on an adjoining Facebook site. And what this suggests to me is that there wasn't one sovereign body in charge of orchestrating these imaginative geographies of the nation, but rather that these came from several different sites which relied on different ways of understanding time and different assumptions of temporality as well. So with this point in mind, I've found it useful to draw on the political theorist William Connolly's notion of a resonance machine in order to better understand how ideas about nationality were being deployed in the context of the Games. Now, his concept of a resonance machine was developed in order to talk about the relationship between capitalist and evangelical interests in the context of US politics. But it's also useful for trying to understand the multiplicity of corporate and statist organisations working as part of a qualitative assemblage in the Games. And interestingly, Connolly argues that such an assemblage cannot be understood without acknowledging affinities of spirituality that jump across different professions of creed, doctrine and philosophy, drawing people together despite creedal differences. I think that it's very difficult to fully understand the success of the London Olympic Games without attending to this spiritual dimension. Another aside here might be, for some of you may know, that Mario Monti decided that Italy would not be bidding for the Olympic Games of 2020, arguing that Italy simply couldn't afford to make an application to host the Games. But in response, a member of the Olympic body said, "I am convinced that you have to make cuts, of course, but when you make cuts, you also have to cultivate a future dream." Now, in William Connolly's work, he goes back to some of the writings of Max Weber to try and, who famously wrote, of course, about the conditions of capitalism in Northern Europe at the turn of the 20th century, and how the mounting sense of rationalization of social and economic life invited a corresponding search for meaning, symbolized by the nation, but also, interestingly, symbolized by the idea of a heroic individual who could strive above ordinary mortals like us here. So for Weber, Max Weber, nationalism emerged as a necessary response to these dismal nihilistic context. And of course, the conditions of capitalism are very different today, but nevertheless, I think there's something interesting here in Weber's attempt to situate the nation as a value orientation that can provide meaning in meaningless times, and how this perhaps resonates in the context of the new austerity. Now I want to move on to a short example, perhaps, of the resonance machine, and one way in which I've tried to access the idea of this, the atmosphere of the games. One cut into that question, because of course it's there are so many different ways in which I could have gone about a study of the atmosphere of the games, including questions about architecture, such as presented in the former paper. But another approach that I've been toying with is perhaps to try and better understand how media geographies work. Now, in the context of the Olympic Games, I think the fact that these were appeared on television was crucial to the event itself. So it's not just a side issue, but part of the performance, part of the way in which most of us would have experienced the games. And I was particularly interested in an advertising campaign run by the global advertising agency Leo Burnett on behalf of McDonald's, who were a key sponsor of the games. Now, while some critical responses to the Olympics on the left have sought to distinguish the spirit of corporatism encapsulated, say, by McDonald's from the spirit of volunteerism symbolised by these Olympic volunteers, this example shows us that that distinction actually makes no sense, because it was the volunteer games makers were trained by McDonald's in the McDonald's university system that they have. And that the games makers we met and heard about in the press were all selected and presented to us by News International. So I began to carry out interviews with games makers who volunteered at the games because of the way in which they've been described as crucial to the success of the event, and for the way in which they've also been honoured for their contributions towards citizenship and nationhood. But I've also been interviewing creative agencies involved in the media geographies of the games, such as Leo Burnett. Now, this McDonald's advertising campaign was titled We All Make the Games. For those who will be familiar with British politics context, this is a really nice line that echoes with We're All In This Together, which is a line that the British Prime Minister David Cameron used to say, hasn't been saying so much recently. But for the creative team behind this advert were explicitly concerned with securing a mood and an atmosphere. And the aim was to tap into people's emotions about the games, and crucially to reflect what the nation was feeling back to them. Now, we could say that that's always been the aim of advertising. But the temporalities of this campaign, as well as the way in which it operated across different media platforms, is quite interesting. Because while most of McDonald's TV adverts are decided upon weeks before they air, and every detail is considered to the final degree with rigorous scrutiny, for this one it was decided that 4 out of the 5 adverts would run in and through the games themselves, featuring images of people who are enjoying the games in real time, in order to try and capture the liveliness of the event. I'm not going to bother showing the advert, but we're introduced to a variety of sport fans by way of rhyming couplets and a steady beat, a heteronormative vibe, flashes of red, white and blue, an advert that features mostly, but certainly not all, white people, the predictable melody of a Tears for Fears soundtrack. All this suggests that nationalism continues to take place within a homogenous, empty, linear framework. But in keeping the other adverts very open and sending photographers out to several cities in the UK with small compact cameras in order to capture people enjoying the games in real time and without a script, in order to capture what they described as the carnival feel of the event and the rhythms of the games. This advertising campaign was also drawing on another temporality, a sort of splintered, fragmented understanding of time. So they were, for example, inviting people to post their pictures of themselves at the Olympic Games on Facebook sites and emailing them to the company. And then within 24 hours, people were being contacted by text or by email to say that their picture would be going live on the McDonald's advert the next day, or that their picture would go up on the billboard in Piccadilly Circus the next day, and that they were featured in the We All Make the Games programme and campaign. So this kind of mobilising of affect, if you want, worked as part of a media relay where people actually travelled from many cities in the UK in order to see their picture on a poster board in London. And again, this sort of suggests another temporality of nationalism at work. Now, this has been mentioned already in the context of work of Walter Benjamin, and his writings on shock that you talked about earlier. Of course, this is precisely why Walter Benjamin was also interested in adverts, because they represent quite a unique form of unique tempo, if you want. Now, to close and sum up, I mean, in the interviews with the games makers, I'm trying to explore some of the constituencies at the edges of this resonance machine in order to try and think about disruptions to it, or alternative examples of urban encounters and coming together that might defy the nationalist framework or challenge it in some way. And some of the themes that are quite that are coming through those interviews, and I'm still very much in the early days of carrying these out, is how international the group of volunteers at the games were. So people enjoyed meeting people from all over the world, and yet when it was very much scripted in the UK context as that these volunteers were performing a form of national citizenship or national duty, even a sort of almost a renewed form of military service or something. Whereas in the actual event, these were not necessarily British citizens at all who were volunteering at the games. Another interesting theme that's coming through is just how many people actually dropped out of their work participating at the games or during the training towards the games because of the vast amounts of money they had to spend on accommodation and training sessions in order to be able to volunteer at the games. So for example, most of them were being asked to do jobs that some of them didn't feel qualified to do as well, such as driving around London, picking up and dropping off members of the Olympic family. And several of the people I've spoken to had never even visited London before, and they were being asked to drive to Mayfair to pick someone up within 15 minutes sort of thing. So this led to why several people dropped out of the volunteering opportunity. Anyway, these interviews with games makers perhaps are offering another entry point into question about alternative collectivities and atmospheres of coming together at the Olympics in an attempt to get away from this suggestion of a community in unity, which forms the main main theme of the Games, if you want, of the aura of sovereignty performed at the Games. And that's where I've reached with this project so far, but I would be very grateful for any feedback and suggestions on where I might take this work further. Thank you.